Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is engineer and music tech writer Barry Rudolph, but first I want to talk about barcodes and SoundScan. Many of you already know that if you're going to release a physical product, you need a barcode, and here's why. If you want to chart on Billboard, you need a barcode, because that's what SoundScan reads in order to determine the number of sales. So let's go back and look at a little bit of history about the barcode and about SoundScan. Before 1991, when SoundScan was initiated, basically what would happen was Billboard would call up a number of music retailers and ask, what's selling? Simple as that. They just call around to get an idea of what was selling. And they would have this informal poll, and then that would result in the charts. Well, as you can imagine, that was kind of easy to game, because once you found out which ones were the reporting stores, then you can go in there and you can make deals with the manager, you can make deals with people to go in and buy stuff. And believe me, a lot of records in the past became big hits because of that. There's even a rumor that that's how the Beatles got their first hit, because of course Brian Epstein owned record stores. He owned four big ones, and they all reported to the English equivalent of Billboard. But in the States, it happened here a lot as well. And after a while, everybody wanted a fairer system, so what came about was SoundScan. Now, SoundScan looked at the barcodes very impartially to determine what was sold. And this sounds like the perfect system, except it didn't quite work that way. At one point in time, there were 14,000 stores that were actually involved with SoundScan, which sounds like a huge number of record stores, but that wasn't all of them. This was only the 14,000 largest ones. And there were a whole lot of mom and pop stores that weren't involved because SoundScan was actually too expensive and they didn't really get all that much out of it. So there's 14,000 stores that reported. Now, once again, just think about this, 14,000 stores. And now we're down to about 2,500 record stores through the United States. So you can see the decline has been really, really drastic. That said, there were 14,000 stores, but they didn't include the mom and pop stores. So what SoundScan did was they instituted a weighting system. So some stores counted more than others. In other words, if a big store in Chicago sold one record, it might be counted as 2 or 5 or even 10 as compared to a small mom and pop store someplace, which would count only as 1. That information was never officially given out to anyone, but after a while, the record companies could make a reasonable assumption which stores actually carried the most weight, and they could see if they could make sure that there were more sales going out of there. And again, what they would do is they would get a bunch of college students to go in and buy records from these stores. And then, of course, the record gained a higher chart position. So this is the way the game was played. Now, of course, this doesn't carry as much weight because, hey, we're not selling as many physical products. There are still CDs being sold. There are still vinyl products. And if you want to be counted on Billboard for sales, you need a barcode, because if you don't have a barcode, you're not going to be counted at all. So that's why you need a barcode, simply for SoundScan. It's becoming obsolete as sales go away, sales of music, and we go into a streaming world. But there'll always be some music sales that will happen. But probably we won't count on sales so much. And even the Billboard charts now don't rely on sales. They look at social media. They look at YouTube views. And they look at radio airplay as well as sales. So now it's a little bit more all-encompassing. Next thing I want to talk about is pre-production. And this is something that a lot of producers forget about. They don't spend enough time in pre-production, or they don't realize why they need it. And I want to talk about the pre-pre-production. This is even before you get in a rehearsal studio with the artist. Because first of all, you have to get the job, and you get the job by meeting the artist. So that's the very first thing that happens in pre-production, meeting the artist. And you might have to meet several times because the artist might be meeting other producers at the same time or other engineers. So you have to get the gig, and that's the first thing. But then after you figured out that you like each other and you want to work together, then comes the next part. And this is really critical, and again, it's way overlooked. This would be getting to know the artist. So the reason why you want to get to know the artist is because that will influence how you work with the artist down the line. There's a number of questions that you could ask. Way back in the day, one of the things that we'd do, we'd go to the artist's house, we'd get the vinyl records out, and just grab a bunch, throw them on the floor, and say, okay, tell me what you like about each one. And of course, then we went to CDs. It's kind of the same thing. Not quite as glamorous because they make a different sound when you throw them on the floor. Now, today, we pretty much do that with playlists, but the questions are pretty much the same. You look at what the artist is listening to and you say, okay, what do you like about these artists? What is so special about these artists? What grabs you? What do you think is so cool about these artists? The next thing you might ask is, do you like the sound of the recordings? Which ones do you like? Which ones don't you like? Another question might be, what recordings do you really like the sound of? Now take notice, all this is guiding you in a direction of knowing what the artist likes and what the artist doesn't like, because down the line, that will stop you from making a mistake, from suggesting something that the artist will just hate right off and think sometimes less of you, because don't forget, they don't really know you that well. So you want to make sure that you're really on the side of the artist. Another thing is, what are your favorite albums or what are your favorite songs and why? What is it about these songs or what is it about these albums or the artist that really attracts you? Another thing you might ask is, what are your biggest influences and why? Finally, a really big question is, what does the artist like about you, the producer or engineer? What's attractive in you that they really dig? Now, if you have some sort of a track record, if there's artists you've done before that they like, you might find out why. Do they like the sound? Do they like the production? What do they like about what you did? All this info will help you attain the artist's vision. And let's face it, we're working for the artist. Yes, you work for a record label sometimes, less so these days, but in the end, we're all trying to make sure that the artist attains that vision that they have in their mind, that they might not be able to get out. They might not be able to tell people exactly what it is, but by having some of this info, we can pull it out of them and make sure that they're happy with the work that we do. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. My guest today is someone that you might think that you know, but I bet you really don't know a lot of the background about Barry Rudolph. Barry has been writing tech articles and columns in magazines like Mix and Music Connection for years, and he has a couple of super informative websites. But he's also an engineer of some note, and he's worked on an array of big albums with major artists like Rod Stewart, Lynyrd Skynyrd, Waylon Jennings, Ray Charles, and many more. In fact, Barry's first big hits were Al Wilson's Show and Tell and Hall & Oates' Sarah Smile way back when. I talk with Barry via Skype from his studio in Hollywood. So, Barry, thanks so much for being in my inner circle. I've been wanting to talk to you on the podcast for quite some time. Thanks for being here.
Great. Thanks for the opportunity inviting me, and thanks for that great book I use in my project studio design class at Musicians Institute.
Oh, it's a studio builder's handbook, right?
Right.
Oh, great. Well, thank you for the plug. I appreciate it. Let's go back to when you first started. Did you start in Atlanta?
No. I started in Hollywood, actually West Hollywood at Larrabee. In terms of Hollywood, my first beginnings go back to Orange County at a studio called United Audio. And I worked there for about a year and heard about Larrabee changing hands and went up, and lo and behold, they hired me as a staff, go for this, go for that.
Yeah. And how long were you there?
Let's see. Larrabee was from about 1970 or a little before, maybe 1970 to about, I'm going to say 75, just after Hall & Oates record, Silver Album, which I did there, among others.
So when did you begin to engineer?
68, 69, something like that.
Okay, right off, you were an engineer then. You didn't spend much time as an assistant, I assume?
At the first studio I was, yeah, I edited tape, chopped up narration and stuff like that, and second engineered, and then went on to first engineer in Orange County. When I made the trip up to Los Angeles and Larrabee, I went back to being assistant, yeah, for quite a while there. And eventually, in those days, the assistant, the first job at Larrabee was disc cutting, mono acetates. So that was that was a good place. You could make mistakes, and it's basically you throw away the acetate and no one knew about it.
But that, you know, that's similar to the EMI, the Abbey Road way of doing things, where they made you a tape op first, and then before you became an engineer, then you became then you're an assistant, and then before you became a first engineer, then they put you in mastering. And the idea being that it was more difficult to get everything on a disc than it was on tape. So that's, you know, basically where you got some chops.
Yeah, exactly. It was a mono disc cutter, a Neumann. It had the, we had a Pultec EQ, I think I remember, and a Fairchild 660. And I'd fool around with that, fool around with setting, cutting stuff all which way. And you kind of found out what really worked and what didn't, because generally it didn't work when the record skipped.
I'd say so. Well, okay. So I know you went to Atlanta for a while. Was that with Lynyrd Skynyrd, doing Lynyrd Skynyrd? How did that work?
Yeah. How that happened was that I had met Tom Dowd in L.A. At a studio called Clover Studios, and he worked on a band from Texas that on Atlantic that Ahmet Erdogan had Tom do it. Tom did it as a favor to Ahmet. I worked with this band and Tom, and he was sufficiently impressed, I guess, that he asked me to fly up to Canada to work with him and Rod Stewart on an album called Footloose Fancy Free, and the single was Hot Legs. And flew up to Toronto and started working on that record for about a week, and then Rod cut it short to come back to L.A. And Tom said, you know, I'm going to go over time with Rod here. Can you go down to Atlanta and work with these guys, Lynyrd Skynyrd, just stay with them for about a week until I get there? And so I said, okay. And that's how I went down to Atlanta, specifically Doraville, which is outside of Atlanta, to do that record.
Well, and which record was that?
It's called Street Survivors.
Oh, no kidding. That was the one. Wow. That was very cool. I mean, you're able to work with some legends between Rod and between Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Yep.
That's incredible. So I was looking at your discography a little while ago, and I saw that you work with Rod on quite a lot of records.
Yeah, actually, that record, Footloose Fancy Free and Hot Legs, was the first one. And then it just turned out 20 years later, I think, I worked on an album called When We Were the New Boys. And that was a record that Rod started with up at Oliver Lieber's studio. He used a Le Mobile truck. And subsequently, we went to Rod's house to finish it pretty much with the Le Mobile truck. And I ended up doing a mix of the record at Record One. And Kevin Savagar was involved with that. And so, it was kind of interesting to see the guy again after 20-some years.
How involved was Rod in tracking and everything? Was he there all the time, or did he just come in and do vocals?
For both records that I did with him, there all the time. Did live vocals. In fact, Oliver had a vocal booth built right off his control room at the house, because Rod just wanted to go in the booth, do the vocal, come right back out and hear playbacks kind of instantly. So, completely. He would be there the whole time, working on arrangements, changes, parts, everything.
That's cool. Yeah, that's great when you have an artist like that that's so hands-on. But that's probably why they're as big as they are.
You know? Rod's a smart person in a lot of ways. Very, he's like a lot of artists that I've worked with, Waylon Jennings, Daryl Hall. They sort of read the room. It's interesting. They kind of look around the room and see kind of the reaction to certain things happen in the music. It's kind of interesting.
Let's go back to Skynyrd for a second. Do you mind talking about that?
No, no, not at all. Not at all.
Because I know you might be bored with this by now. I'm sure.
No. Always. I mean, those guys about killed me. I was with them for about a week. And when I came back, I was like ready for the hospital.
In what way?
Well, their session started at about 3 p.m. and which is not unusual, I guess. And they would go till about 3 a.m. and down there they had dry and wet counties and they seemed to know all the ones that stayed open all night.
Okay, I get it.
And then get back to the hotel at 10 a.m.
Yeah, right. That would do it to me too, that's for sure. Did you record that in 16 track?
Yeah, 24 track. Was a 3M 79. I did four songs. I did four songs with them, and Rodney Mills was the engineer, and they had another engineer, Kevin, I want to say Elson. And when I got there, first night, I'm sitting on the bed with Ronnie Van Zandt and Gary Rossington in the hotel, we're just hanging out. And Ronnie said to me, look, we cut all this stuff at Criteria in Miami, and we hate it. We don't like the sound. We don't like our performance. We don't like any of it. We want to do it all over. And Tommy Dowd told me, he said, I just want you to go down there and hang with them. They're doing overdubs. That's what I said. I called him up. I said, call up Tommy Dowd. And he's back in L.A. at Cherokee with Rod. And I said, Houston, we have a problem. But, I said, Tom, these guys, they're kind of unhappy with what you've already cut, the tracks and everything, and they just want to recut all of it. And Tom Dowd I never worked with a guy that's such a cool head about everything, never got anxious or angry or anything. He says to me, okay, well, cut some tracks, hang out, have a good time. I got to go. Just blew me away, that kind of like, it's not that he's not interested, it's just that it's kind of like no stress.
Well, there you go again, working with Tom Dowd. I mean, that's pretty heavy, Barry. That really is. It may have been nothing to you working with him at the time, but boy, to hear those stories, that's incredible, because he's a godfather of our industry. Jeez.
Yeah. And I might just throw in, I think this week or at some point is the anniversary of his, or not anniversary, his birthday.
Yeah.
Something like that. Cause I know I heard from Dana Dowd, his daughter, and she's making that known.
Very cool. So he just produced them when you work with them, right?
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't there while I worked with him. He was back in L.A. working with Rod and Andy Johns.
Yeah, but didn't you work with them with Rod though, as well?
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah. In that Canada, yeah. The first album, Footloose Fancy Free, that was at a place called Mantis Sound. The studio tore down the whole setup after we'd gotten sounds and everything. And it was three guitars, bass and drums, Carmine Appice, big kit. The whole place is full of, all set up. And the next day we come in and it's all struck.
Oh.
And I told the studio, I said, didn't we book Lockout for 2 weeks? And they go, yeah, but we had a jingle. I don't know. And I said, wow. And again, Tom Dowd just says, okay, we'll set up again. We'll get sounds. We'll get better sounds. So, okay.
It's a great attitude.
Yeah. I mean, what are you going to do?
Did he ever touch the console while you were there?
Tom Dowd would, when he needed to, it was sort of, we were tracking and it was sort of, he was very concerned with the arrangement. He would write little charts and just a rock band. And he would talk about more of musical and arrangement than at least at that time,
technical, much more about the kind of important stuff at the moment. He kind of just left the sound and the mix and whatever was going on to me at that time.
And he didn't go about placing mics or anything, just left it all to you?
Pretty much. I mean, he would if something didn't sound right or he saw something that was wackadoo, he might mention something or, but no, he didn't really, at that time anyway, I didn't see any of that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like a mentor in some ways too, because he would talk about things. Like he said something like, we're talking about mixing, and he says, okay. He has a sort of East Coast Connecticut kind of accent. Okay, I'm going to show you how to mix the bass and the kick. I said, okay. Just turn the monitors off. What? Yeah, just turn those things off. He says, okay, where's the bass drum track? And I said, it's right here. And he pushes the fader up, and it's hitting like -5 or something. And he says, okay, mute that. Put up the bass. And put up the bass guitar. And the bass guitar is hitting about -5. He goes, okay, turn them both on. I said, okay. And it's about, I don't know, -2 now, you know, combined.
Yeah.
He's like, okay, that's it. Turn the monitors back on. Check it out.
Whatever works.
Yeah. You know, kind of, I don't know. I think we ended up changing it, of course, later on, but he was just kind of proving a point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you started, back in the early 70s, well, 60s, actually, and I know you to not be someone that's tied to the past. You're as progressive as anyone that I know in the business, and you don't mind being in the box, right?
Not at all. No, not at all. I look at those times when I was coming up and other people were coming up, and I kind of, that was then. We did what the technology we had. We did things for specific reasons. I mean, and now it's so much better. If I had some of the technology that I wished for back then, certain ideas I had, but just nobody made any gear that did those kinds of things, and certainly no Pro Tools. I don't know what would have happened, but I don't really look. I look at that back at nostalgia, and I'm not a very nostalgic person, so I just look back at it, and okay, that was then, you know, and this is now.
Yeah, I look at it the same way. As a matter of fact, the year before, I did an album that was on tape, only because the artist insisted of doing it that way. And I hated every minute of it. And sure, it sounded good, but was it that much better? No, not in my opinion. And the real pain was, okay, you need another take. Everybody's hot. You want to do another one. And the song is 4 minutes long and you have 3 minutes and 45 seconds of tape. And so you have to wind it off and then wind another reel on. It's 10 minutes later and the band has lost it by then. And that was a real drag to me.
Yeah, I really still believe that the pace of the recording session, particularly in tracking and overdubbing, is governed by how fast or how with what accuracy you can locate to a particular spot on the tape. Well, in my day, the tape deck. Now it's a no-brainer with Pro Tools. You can just punch in the bar number and go to it if you know the right bar number. But the pace of the session, how it flows, how fast, how slow, how leisurely, how frenetic, the demands of the artist, so forth and so on, is all controlled there.
Yeah.
And the ability to go exactly where you want to go, when you want to go, and do exactly what you need, you know, really on the ball. And gosh, with Pro Tools, you have a good Pro Tools operator, you can do anything you want. Go as slow or as fast or anywhere you want to go, and that's really important. And I found when I was a second engineer that became an asset with a lot of producers and engineers, especially for jingles and film work where you need to go exactly, you have to have your locate list and all that and go right there and know what track to punch in and all that stuff.
Well, they rarely want to go slower, that's for sure. So the faster you can make it, the better. It's very cool. Okay, all right. So describe your current setup.
Okay, so I have an acoustically treated alcove in my house. I'm Pro Tools 11 HD. I'm in the process of some different monitor choices. Right now I have a pair of Atoms powered and a Stens, of course. I do use a sub. I'm in the middle of thinking about going back to totally passive monitors, like a pair of Tannoy ML10s or a SGM10s with Mastering Lab crossovers, something like that. And I'm using a Sigma summing unit, 32 channels of sum, and right now an Avocet monitor controller for monitoring. And you know, it's a lot of preamps and outboard, a few compressors and such, 500 racks, stuff like that.
I know for me, one of the problems that I had when I was doing gear reviews for EQ Magazine was that it got me off my reference point a lot, especially with monitors. You listen to monitors and then, okay, you have to put new ones up. And then it would throw me off just enough that it would take some time to get back sometimes. And I know you do an awful lot of gear stuff. I want to talk about more about that in a second. But does that occur to you where, you know, changing gear out constantly is a hassle?
I have my reference point. You know, I have my Benchmark Media DAC and ADC converters, those pretty constant, unless I'm reviewing a converter. But it would still be, I mean, I don't do ABs specifically. I do with the monitors. I do know these Atoms pretty well and know what they are. But really, the acoustics of the space are important, because pretty much if you get them straight, just about anything's going to sound a lot better. You know, you're not chasing, around trying to get a sound that's just not going to happen in that space.
So tell me again what you did for your space acoustically.
Okay, so I have, let's start with a cloud. I have four diffusers and two absorption on the ceiling, and they're spaced from the ceiling. That's the cloud. I have four 2x4 these Orlex, they're 2-inch thick, and they're spaced off the walls about 2.5 inches, or actually more. They're spaced 3.5 inches off the surface. And then I have bass traps in the corners, and the whole 90-degree front wall to ceiling, that's all bass trapped. And then rug on the floor, curtains, everything is very symmetrical. Whatever's on the left is on the right. It's working pretty well. I do have a nasty room mode at the listening position. I call it the curse of the 8-foot ceiling.
Yeah.
And I'm working on that.
Well, hey, it happens to everybody, especially in, you know, if it's not a from the ground up room where you can choose your dimensions. So
right.
It sounds like you've probably done pretty well with it.
Yeah, I mean, it pings out. I mean, I've measured it. It's pretty good. Maybe a little too much absorption in the mids and highs, and I'm working on that. I'm thinking about taking up the carpet. That'll fix that.
Yeah.
And so we'll see.
How did you get into writing?
Actually, I got into writing about 1985. A friend of mine, Billy Chaffee, wrote a column called Field Test in Music Connection, and he, a guitar player, and he just didn't want to write it anymore. So he said, "You want to write this column?" And I said, "Sure." So I've been writing that column for Music Connection since then. It's morphed into New Toys, which is the name I gave it when they wanted more than just one piece reviewed on a page. So now I do 8 an issue for them.
That's a lot.
Well, they're short. They're 200 worders or less. So they're more, a lot of them are product intros. Some of the stuff I actually get and try out and put a couple of sentences about, you know, some opinions. So it's fun.
One of the problems I had, again, going back to my testing days, and I still have today when people send me stuff, is just getting the time to do it. And it's not like you can throw a lot of stuff in the middle of a session. And I learned early on doing that can be a disaster sometimes. So for me, I would have to, you know, basically schedule out times in order to do it and make sure that whatever I was working on would be amenable to it. So how do you do that?
Well, yeah, I sometimes will parallel whatever I'm reviewing along with whatever I normally use or the studio has. For example, microphones. I might, if I was using, had some mics to try on overhead, drum overheads, I'd put those up, but I'd also put up my regular go-tos, for example, and I might have those other overheads go into another pair of tracks or make the decision right off the bat, you know. So that's one way of doing it. Compressor, same thing. When things better in an overdub mode, kind of when you're overdubbing a guitar or bass or something, you could try it out real quickly and see how it's working. That works out pretty well to do it that way. Yeah, depending on the producer might have certain ideas and say, I want to use a LA-2A and not that thing you got there.
Yeah, right. What's the coolest piece of gear you've seen in 2014?
Oh, boy, there's lots of them. Of course, we just had the AES, so I have to sort of default to the couple of things I saw there. Of course, the SSL, the little new SSL, I have not tried it. It's too new, but that certainly looked like pretty good product for the money, it seems.
No kidding.
I mean, I don't know how they can do that, but we shall see.
The XL console, right?
Right.
Yeah, right. With the 500 rack built in, yeah.
Right. They were very smart to do that because obviously you can plug anything you want in the little 500 area.
Yeah.
So, I also liked Avid's S3, which is a derivation of their live S3 L controller. That's a controller, and that of course means that you're Pro Tools centric, but it also controls other software. Actually, it'll control anything that uses Yukon, so Logic, Nuendo, Cubase, Ableton, I believe, and you know most any of them. That's pretty cool.
Okay, that's cool. What's your favorite microphone so far?
Oh, I think for vocals, if it's a girl, it's either a C12, the C800G is nice. It's a bright mic. Generally, you just have to watch for S's on a mic like that. Same with the C12, really. Male vocals, I go between a U67 or a Bronner VM1.
Yeah.
It's nice mics.
Good
Rod choice. Rod is a U67. In fact, uses the same mic on the record he just did with Kevin Savagar. It's the same exact mic that he used when I recorded that album up at Oliver Liebert. Yeah.
Does he own it?
No, it's actually a rental.
Amazing. What clones have impressed you?
Microphones?
Yeah, microphone clones, yeah.
Haven't really. I don't know. Next question.
Okay. When you're tracking, how has your tracking changed between going back to 1970 and the way it is now?
Well, it's completely changed. I think most producers want much more control over the individual instruments for purposes of whatever, replacing or modifying later in the mix. Whereas when I started, it was about capturing the whole band. even if it was only three or four guys. Occasionally, yeah, you'd punch in something to repair something, but I don't know. It wasn't thought of as like we could fix it later. There wasn't that kind of thought going on. It was kind of like the guys are here now. We got 3 hours, and we got to get three tracks. And now it's sort of they might get a track, or they might get they might do drum overdubs. So I don't know. I would say the differences are that there's a lot more meticulous microscoping, it seems like, now than there were back when I started.
Has your miking technique changed?
Not really. There's better mics. Maybe use more mics, but pretty much the same with overheads. I'm a wide space, small diaphragm guy. I don't know. Pretty much the same.
How about guitar amps? Does that change at all?
Guitar amps.
Only from the standpoint that so many people now have changed from their favorite, which might have been a 57, to like a Royer, you know, an R21.
Because they're more prevalent and available and a lot less money. When I started, there was about two choices, RCA 77 and a 44, and most of them didn't work or had something wrong with them. If you found one, a good one, you wouldn't put it on a loud source because you were afraid of blowing it out. But now, with so many different cool ribbons out there, Byers, Royer, AEA, you have a lot of, they sound great on electric guitars. Don't get me wrong. It's just that back in the day, we're too concerned with popping the ribbon.
What were you using back in the day? Were you using a 57 or were you using a U67? What were you using?
Yeah, I used a 57, a U67. If I had one with a condenser, let's see what else. Sometimes a SM58, sometimes an SM. I don't know if they had a 7. They had a big dynamic that I used to use.
It was a 5, I think, back. An SM5, I think.
Yeah, it was a big old fat thing.
Yeah.
And mostly dynamic, I would say, on electric guitar amps.
And how about the bass? When did you see direct boxes
always on
the bass guitar? Always?
Always. It was always direct. They had Electrovoice made an inline direct. It was sort of had like a quarter inch screw-on connector on one end and a cable with an XLR in the other, and you just plugged it right into the bass. But the players, yeah, always a direct, and they would have like a Fender Bassman, one of those four-speaker Fender amps. Looks like a concert amp, but it's a Bassman.
That's what
like Joe Osborne or Carol Kay would use one of those, and you would rarely mic it. At least I rarely mic'd it because they really were only there for them to tune up and monitor themselves a little bit. Rarely did I ever mic that thing.
You know, it's funny because the reason why I asked the question is on the East Coast, we didn't really see directs all that often until the mid-70s.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying they weren't around. It's just they weren't prevalent. They weren't in every studio. As a matter of fact, I didn't make a good living, but I made a fair amount of money making my own direct boxes for people for a while because no one knew how to do it. And I just copied something, I guess a circuit out of REP. I think it was the famous Dean Jensen one, and made direct boxes for a while. And you know, that was a big deal for everybody. But I guess it wasn't out here. I didn't even know about that EV thing.
Yeah, I mean, Electrovoice... Electrovoice. In fact, Larrabee, I think, only had one. The studio I started in Orange County had one direct box, and that was an EV thing. I say EV, I'm pretty sure of that. Mm-hmm. And it was like the kind of transformer they would put when they just wanted to change a high impedance to low impedance. Had no ground switch or anything like that. It was just a thing in the cable. But yeah.
I don't know. California, I think about the differences in, and this is sort of something you might, could be a good study to do, the difference between East Coast engineers versus West Coast and the sort of the aesthetic of East and West Coast music. And then contrast in general the engineering from West and East Coast with England, British engineers, and their sort of take on all of it. And it still kind of still exists today, I might add, that the differences that I see.
What differences do you see? I actually did this in the Mixing Engineer's Handbook. It's the first chapter. But what differences do you see today? Because I see less of them than you know, there were in the 70s and 80s.
Between what, East and West Coast?
Yeah.
Oh, in general, East Coast tends to compress more.
Yeah.
And go for a, how can I say it, a more in-your-face, kind of aggressive sound. We're talking about contemporary pop music, of course.
Yeah.
Whereas West Coast, if you think about the recordings that came out of San Francisco and L.A., it was more about high fidelity, more about, you know, how can you get the cleanest, clearest, most fidelic sound. So, you contrast, say, records of the time like Young Rascals, that sound versus the Beach Boys. And the way their records sounded, or the Mamas and Papas, California, or the psychedelic bands and the way they sounded with bands and music, you know, from back east. So you can hear how there was more, say, West Coast, maybe more reverb, more harmonies in the vocals, maybe a little bit more. So, I mean, we're talking about generalities, but that's kind of the way I always sort of heard East and West Coast. British and in this country, complete almost apples and oranges in terms of their engineering aesthetics. Completely different thing.
Well, especially in the layering of the effects, so right. Much more over there. Yeah, no, you hit it exactly as I saw it as well, and exactly as in the book. But again, I see less of it these days because there's sort of a homogenization with everybody moving around so much that, you know, there's less of it to me than there was before. But yeah, you still hear that New York compression happening.
Well, some of the engineers that come from the East Coast, they have a style and it tends towards a lot of compressors.
Yeah.
And whereas out here, there is still that, of course, and it is less of a difference. You're right. Less of a difference. Everybody wants to be up front and loud.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one thing that'll never change, I guess. Huh? Last question for you. What's the best piece of business advice that you ever received from someone or that you learned along the way?
Yeah, getting paid, I guess. I mean, is the short answer. know who you work with, I suppose, and that stuff takes care of itself. If you're working with flaky people, you're going to have those kinds of things. But business, yeah, I would say as far as advice to is save money, of course. I you're self-employed, so all the usual things you read about self-employed people. And my motto was early on to have multiple streams of income, not just from engineering, but other places. And the writing is part of that, although it's not much of a stream money-wise, but it's there. But I also, during the 70s, when it was slow in the studio, I used to buy and flip houses on the side. Yeah. So that was something.
I didn't know that about you.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
Yeah, once in a while. Yeah, when I was doing that Skynyrd album, I had just sold a house in Laurel Canyon and moved to the Valley and was in the middle. In fact, the house is in escrow when Tom Dowd called me to go to Canada. And when I got back and then went to, after I got back from Atlanta area, yeah, the house had closed. I could move in.
Very cool. Thanks so much, Barry. I really appreciate your time, and it was a great conversation, as always.
You got it, Bobby. Anytime. Good luck, and thank you.
To find out more about Barry, go to barryrudolph.com, barryrudolph.com, and you can also check out his GearLust site at gearlust.com, which is very, very cool. That's gearlust.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyointercircle.com. It's questions@bobbyointercircle.com. Many, many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the Producer Podcast at theproducer.club. He's responsible for putting this show together. I really appreciate it. Thanks, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or you can go to bobbyointercircle.com or find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski, and I'll see you next time.